Hello, Guy Noble with you this morning, sitting in one last time for Richard Adey. He'll be back on Monday. Now, I know that's a slightly unconventional start to Life Matters Friday talkback, but that little nursery rhyme is quite profound for me. It was the first song that I can actually remember. And my mother used to sing it to me at the age of around about two or three, and for some reason, I used to burst into tears on hearing it. I'm not quite sure why, whether it was the tune structure or the underlying harmony, but I would burst into tears, but then I'd want to hear it again and again, and I'm even getting a bit sniffly hearing it again after all these years. Well, I've moved on since Oranges and Lemons, and in my other job as a conductor with orchestras, music of all kinds now forms the backbone of my life, but I wonder what role does it play for you? We're not talking about the background noise, but those critical musical moments in your life when you are switched on to music. How does it bond you to other people? And does it get you through hard times? What was that one special piece that you either heard in your very early childhood or you come back to help you through difficult times in your life? Of course, we want to hear from you this morning about the power of music in your life. So call us on 1300 225 576, or if you're in WA, you can ring our listener line on 02 833 1430, or of course you can head for the guest book and we'll read your comments during the show. But I'm delighted to welcome David Hobson, first guest. David is a leading opera singer and a composer, but he's performed in all sorts of genres, in musicals, even a rock band. He's performed at the AFL Grand Final and before the Queen. He won two series of It Takes Two on Channel 7, and he can dance pretty well too. You may have seen him on Dancing with the Stars. And I have to say, I've even conducted him in concert myself. So, David, welcome to Life Matters.
Morning, Guy. How are you going?
I'm very well. Now, David, you've got such a crazy range of musical experience there. What was your first memory of music?
Gee, you know, I have such a poor memory of my childhood in any event, because it was relatively happy, to tell you the truth. But there were a couple of moments that really stick out for me. I think one was being around my father and his friends singing around a piano. So that was like a continuous continuous event that happened on weekends at our place in Ballarat.
What sort of stuff did you play and sing?
Well, what would he do? Well, lots of popular ballads. He was a light baritone, and they used to sing popular ballads a la Peter Dawson. Also the popular musicals of the day, whether it be anything from Oklahoma to Kismet to My Fair Lady to Oliver. And my sisters also played the piano. So it was a kind of a string of songs, I guess, more than anything else, more than just one event. But I particularly remember going to the local theatre and sitting in on a general rehearsal for, I would have been about four or five at the time, I think, where my father was playing Hajj in Kismet, which was a musical written by Wright and Forrest based on Borodin's music.
So it was set in Baghdad, that's right. Now, where was this taking place? You're a Ballarat boy, aren't you?
This is in Ballarat, which is right. In Western Victoria, a small town. And I remember being struck by the dramatic impact of that music, because it was basically based on that Russian music with Western sensibility, you know, making it a Broadway show. So I think that was my first real experience. And then from there I went and sang in church choirs. But probably my father's involvement in music was my first real experience, I guess.
And did that set you on the road to being a musician, if some sort, whatever it was going to be? Did you always know?
No, it must have. It must have, because I had a... my mother was also... In fact, she had the radio, Aral Dighted, on Radio National back then, which was where you got your staple diet of classical music before it became this Radio National.
You're going to win no favours saying things like that on this station.
My mother bought me, what were those talking books back then, where they would have the lives of composers with a reading book and a record. So I remember at an early age her trying to, you know, infiltrate my mind with classical music, with the stories of Bach and Mozart and Beethoven and what have you. So I guess I was influenced by that as well.
And of course, it wasn't all just musicals for you, and it wasn't all just classical, but you've actually you've had some other music in your life. In fact, we're going to play something now that had a bit of an impact in your teens, so just hold on to your seats for this track. Here it comes.
I
So, David, tell us about how Led Zeppelin got into your brain and what age.
Well, I guess that's when the hormones started to kick in, Guy. So up to that point, I was still in the church choir and the school choir, and I think I might have just played in Oliver and done things like that for the local musical society and had a healthy dose of classical music in my head. But once my hormones kicked in, Led Zeppelin called and Black Sabbath. But actually, even in listening to that track, which is off Led Zeppelin 4, I can hear why, you know, retrospectively, why it interested me. I mean, there's a real drama and a real intensity to the performance and the sound and Robert Plant's voice. I mean, it's exciting, isn't it? So as a teenager, I was really drawn to that. To that music.
And could you play guitar like that? Did you air guitar
tried to emulate it. Yeah, I had a little garage band at that, you know, would have been about 13 at the time, 12 or 13, and worked at my dad's local store over the summer and bought a guitar and amp, and away we went with some friends. Yeah. But it's interesting how the cycle of one's life. Certain music always, well, for me it was, I think I followed a pretty regular pattern of how, you know, your body and your brain changes and then you are attracted to certain music. So it, as I said, in my early teens it was rock, you know, real rock and roll, and in my late teens it became a little bit more sophisticated and I was drawn to jazz rock and jazz. Listening back to that music now, which I haven't heard Led Zeppelin for a while, it still excites me.
My guest is David Hobson this morning on Life Matters, and we're talking about music that's important to you and how music might have affected your life. And obviously, David, it affects your life because you perform it, but there's a big distance between Led Zeppelin and, say, singing Rodolfo and La Boheme, which was probably one of your first major hits. Or is there not?
Well, I don't know if there is. I mean, there's a... You know, the physical energy required to sing something like Led Zeppelin, and actually listen to Robert Plant's voice, it also reminds me of Ian Gillan, who was the lead singer of Deep Purple. And I remember also being heavily influenced by Jesus Christ Superstar in my late teens, and which was a rock opera.
Me too, that amazing production with that dodecahedron thing that I think Brian Thompson designed. I love that. Yep. I actually made a balsa wood version of that at home. How tragic is that?
Oh, well, it's a tragic story. You were moved to do that. But, you know, I don't think there is... Is there a far cry from the dramatic intensity and the physicality required to sing a role like, Judas or Jesus in Superstar? And there is a correlation between singing opera as well. I mean, it's the same kind of... dramatic energy is required, and for the audience a similar effect, I guess. I mean, the only difference is one is amplified and one isn't, and there's the immediacy because Superstar was speaking the language of the time. And even though opera is, you know, we as classical performers are working in a living museum, the energy and the physicality required is not dissimilar in many respects. So I don't find it that far a stretch. In terms of my, as a punter, my enjoyment of it, and as a performer, I guess there is the technique required to sing those different styles. Yeah, there is a difference. That's where the difference lies. I mean, you know, you can get away with screaming out some notes in rock and roll. It would not be all that well respected or looked upon favourably on the opera stage.
No. Is there music now that can move you to tears? Is there something really sort of precious to you that you... you know, crawl away when you're a bit down and want to listen to? What would you listen to? Or is it silence?
Silence is usually good.
Especially as you work in music.
I don't know, someone asked me, you know, recently what, you know, I will still put on a, you know, Dvorak string serenades, for instance, if I'm just wanted to have a calm moment, or I'm still... We'll put on certain Mozart. I tend to always be drawn back to as well as someone as a calming influence. I'm talking a lot about classical music here for a moment, but I remember also another seminal piece of music for me was Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony when I was a late teenager as well. I guess I'm a fairly dramatic person myself, and I was really drawn to the overtly dramatic nature and intensity of that symphony, which is all about Tchaikovsky headlong on the way to death. But for me, it was almost like you can have a good purge listening to a piece of music like that, or Mahler's Fifth Symphony, for instance. But in terms of, you know, I'll put on Coldplay's latest album, you know, Viva La Vida, which will again have a similar effect on me because of you can hear the production. There's as much kind of creativity given over to a recording like that as there is to, say, a Tchaikovsky symphony, in my mind, these days.
Yes.
I love everything. I love the full range of music. I think you're probably the same as me. And I can be moved by honesty and vulnerability and obviously, you know, great craftsmanship as well. I think it depends where you are and how you're feeling in a certain state of, you know, how you're feeling mentally and emotionally in a certain...
That's right. It changes all the time, doesn't it?
It,
you know, where
changes.
You are in your life. So
yep.
That's... David, thanks for joining us this morning and sharing
Absolutely,
some of those
no
thoughts and feelings about music. That's David Hobson, the opera singer, of course, and you've seen him on It Takes Two and Dancing with the Stars. He's all over the shop doing all sorts of different things. Do you have a moment like that, you know, that turned you on to music? And we want to hear from you and what moves you. Can you remember the first experience or who in your family introduced you to music along the way? And of course our number is 1-300-225576. It's 225576. And if you're in WA, of course you can ring our listener line on 02-833-1430. But Christine has rung in from New South Wales, and I think your grade 3 teacher was a big influence, Christine.
Absolutely. Am I allowed to say his name?
Of course.
Mr. Shearman, who for me in my primary school years probably was old and maybe was in his 20s, but no, I have an image of him being an older man. Mr. Shearman at my public school in working class Newcastle used to play every morning. He had the whole school, all the classrooms wired for music, a PA system that was highly sensitive. He wasn't satisfied with the original product and he funded out of his own pocket.
Really?
The PA system that would allow his classical music to be heard properly. And every morning, every class in the school listened to classical music that Mr. Shearman chose for us.
So he was like a sort of a primary school teacher DJ. And did he change the music all the time? Obviously it wasn't the same piece.
He did. He introduced us to things like the Peer Gynt Suite and William Tell Overture, Toy Symphony, those sorts of things that children would relate to, as well as some of the other more grander classical music, such as, you know, Piano Concerto in C Minor, Grieg, and so on. But the fascinating thing was we would listen to a different piece each morning, and then on Friday he would conduct a quiz, and he would play the music and we would have to guess what it was. And classes competed for the honour of knowing, of being able to recognise this wonderful music that Mr. Shearman introduced us to.
That's quite fantastic, and isn't it so true? There's usually one sort of teacher, you know, real inspiration in early days. So does that affect your interest in music, Christine? Do you lean towards the classical, or you're fairly eclectic now in what you listen to?
I'm eclectic. I love all music. My mother played piano, but she played a whole range of things. She played by ear. She would hear a song and just play it. My children have inherited that. It skipped my generation. Have inherited that wonderful ear that she has. But my taste in music has developed over the years into very eclectic. I love all kinds of music. And in fact, it's interesting because we have a little quiz at my workplace each year, and one of the quizzes was we had to give three hints about ourselves. Yeah. And I put forward okay, three pieces of music which are very much 90s music. And my colleagues, who probably perceived me like I did Mr. Shearman, as being older,
yes,
didn't pick it.
Ah, there you
go. They expected something from the 60s and 70s.
Well, good on Mr. Shearman. I hope he's listening in this morning and remembers Christine all those years ago. Thanks for calling, Christine.
Thank you very much.
Now, Joanna from Melbourne also, I think, has a particular piece that reminds you of where you grew up. Is that right, Joanna?
That's right. The Warsaw Concerto.
Ah, right. Which is Poland, is it, we were talking about? Obviously.
No. Richard Adenstall wrote it. It was used as a theme music for a war film called Dangerous Moonlight. And it was a wonderfully stirring and noble piece of music. And my mother and grandmother, who are both self-taught pianists, used to play it on our old upright piano in the kitchen during the Blitz, the air raids, and just to defy Hitler. As soon as the bombs started coming over after the air raid siren went off, Grandma used to thump out the Warsaw Concerto and shake her fist at the ceiling, saying, "Bloody crowds, get back home!" You know. So I have these memories.
So you probably can't even hear that piece without being taken back to those times.
Absolutely.
Now.
I'm back in the kitchen in East London.
Oh, I think wasn't it Spike Milligan who called it the bloody awful Warsaw Concerto?
Oh, did he?
Yes, he did. He used to make a lot of jokes about the Warsaw Concerto because obviously he was very tied up in that war as well. So he would have been quite at home in your kitchen then.
Well, he certainly would, yes.
Thanks, Joanna. That's a great memory of that. So, yes, we want to hear your first musical experiences or pieces like Joanna or Christine, that just stick in the brain that someone's introduced you to. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Guy Noble, sitting in for Richard Adie. He'll be back on Monday. And it's funny, Christine, talking about education. A little bit later, we're going to talk to Stephen Crittenden, who's got a report on Background Briefing. If you listen to Breakfast, you would have heard a little bit of it with Fran Kelly. But the idea that music education in Australia is languishing and we need to do some more about it, so perhaps some more people can have experiences like Christine. So let me now introduce our second guest, who's Tania de Jong. And like David Hobson, Tania has also many musical hats. She's a singer, she's a musical entrepreneur, and her latest project is a thing called Creativity Australia. It's an ambitious plan to bring the power of music into the workplaces of Australia. Tania, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks, Guy.
Nice to have you on the program. Now, what was your first musical memory?
Well, I was brought up in a household where my father and mother played classical music all the time, and because I came from a very classical artistic background. My grandfather was a sculptor and my grandmother an inventor and painter. And so, you know, when the kids at school would say, "What's your favourite pop group, Tania?" I'd be the one who'd say Beethoven.
I don't know that group.
Yes, yeah, so I was considered a bit of a dag at that time.
But you're obviously you had that background, and you're a huge believer in the power of music to transform.
Yes.
And what have you seen it do for kids who don't get much exposure to music? Because you work a lot on that area, don't you? Tell us a bit about what you actually do, because I think people are interested to hear.
Yeah, well, I guess originally, I'm an opera singer like David, and from that wonderful joy of singing opera and musical theatre and all those beautiful songs that I sing with my group Potpourri, which many people know. I then, 10 years ago, founded an organisation called The Song Room, which brings music and arts to disadvantaged children, and has reached nearly 200,000 disadvantaged children with programs that, for many of the children, is their first experience of music in their school or in their lives. And sad to say, as you were saying about music languishing, there were some recent statistics that showed 3 out of 4 Australian primary government school children don't have access to proper music teaching at school. You wonder how that could be possible in a country like Australia. And so through these programs, it's not so much about inspiring the children to be stars as in inspiring them to develop a passion for lifelong learning, because what music does is it opens your heart and your mind and your soul, raises your spirit, and as a result of that you then want to participate more, and kids want to go to school and they start learning better in other, you know, subject areas like maths and science, and disruptive kids actually start really achieving as a result of these sorts of programs.
We'll talk to Stephen about that a bit later on, but it must be very... Can you really quantify that sort of stuff? I mean, there are reports that it must be very hard to say, look, this person has listened to this music and they're going to do better than somebody else, because there must be many, many factors involved.
There is a lot of international research. So when I set up the Song Room, there was a lot of international research at that time coming out of the US, and then subsequently the UK also started to do a major program called Creative Partnerships, and it showed conclusively that children who participate in the arts, particularly from disadvantaged backgrounds, that it levels the playing field for them to achieve better in school and in their lives and in their outcomes, and in many cases might prevent them going down, you know, the pathways of crime and drugs, depression and so on. So, yeah, there's a lot of evidence, and the Song Room's doing a lot of research in this area as well, to illustrate the benefits, particularly to marginalised groups, Indigenous children, for example, and kids from, you know, geographically isolated and economically disadvantaged circumstances.
Tanya, just stay there for a second. We'll be back with you very soon. But let's just take a call now from Marsha in New South Wales, because you had an experience, Marsha, as a child when you were learning piano, I think.
Yes, I was a child that spent nearly 3 years in the children's hospital from the age of eight. And when I came out, I was walking with AIDS and so forth and was not able to go to school. So I missed out a lot on a lot of my young life, and I couldn't go out with my friends as I got older. But I was learning the piano from the late Austin Goldberg in the Sutherland Shire, and he used to take us to the ABC youth concerts.
Mm.
And also I had a relative who worked for the Nicholases in Victoria, who was, Mrs. Nicholas was Hepzibah Menuhin, and I used to correspond with them, and I got very interested in the music of Yehudi Menuhin. He became one of my favourites to listen to. And years later, well, quite a few years later, when I was well in my 20s, he came out and I went to a recital of unaccompanied violin by him at the Sydney Town Hall, and it was just one of the highlights of my life. It was just magic.
Well, you made a good thing bad, or the other way around, a bad thing good by yes. learning the piano and setting you on that path. Thanks, Marsha. Now, John, if I go to you in Victoria, there's a certain theme that gets you back to your childhood, eh?
That's right. It's The Fiend of Blue Hills, which is a 60s radio serial, which most of your older listeners would remember.
Definitely.
But it's one of those songs. I grew up in a large Edwardian house in Kew, and I had a playroom which the children went to play, but the adults had other areas to go. And they would play that straight after the Argonauts, I think. And the Argonauts itself has some bearing on this. But you'd hear the Blue Hills music, and I would be sort of transfixed by it. It was a rather mournful song. And now when I hear it, occasionally you hear it on some sort of radio nostalgia show, and I just get reduced to being five again. It's an amazing. It's rather like the battle line that brings me right back to that. To that moment again, and it's an extraordinarily powerful effect on you.
Music does have that effect, doesn't it, John? Yes. And it's a bit like smell, I think, is the other one. It's very evocative.
Yes. That sort of smell that will immediately stop you in your tracks, and you try and remember, what does that remember? What is that bringing back to you? And it's that song, it just has it to me all the time.
Tanya, is there a piece of music that does that to you as well? Takes you right back?
Look,
sound like you fell off your chair then.
No, I didn't. No, look, probably a piece of music that has always resonated really strongly with me is David mentioned it, funnily enough, which was Mahler's Fifth Symphony. And one day I was reading, there's a book called The Book of Birthdays, and on there, my birthday's on November the 3rd, and on there it said that the piece of music that resonates most strongly with you is Mahler's Fifth. I couldn't believe it. So, I don't know, there's something about Mahler's Fifth and Scorpio, November the 3rd birthdays.
Very powerful piece of music that is too. This is The Life Matters on Radio National. I'm Guy Noble, sitting in for Richard Ady, and Tanya de Jong is one of my guests. We're talking about the power of music today. And now, of course, our Friday talkback number is 1300. 225576. Give us a call and let us know what your experience was, an early experience or any piece of music that is particularly important. And for my next guest, this was the song that changed his view of the world. Wesley Enoch is an Indigenous playwright and director, and he joins me now from Brisbane. Wesley, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks, Guy.
So that, does that take you back? I think you're, what, 23?
Yes, and in fact, in Brisbane, where I grew up. I'm happy to be up here for auditions and stuff, but that song was the most amazing thing at the time. You were just talking before about songs taking you back places, and I hear that song, and I remember being on a dance floor in a gay nightclub in Brisbane, and everyone dancing to that song, and it was the most amazing moment, absolutely incredible.
It was incredible. I mean, it was great musically, but also from the Indigenous side of things. That was a real breakthrough, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's interesting, this thing about, you know, the capital P politics of, you know, the Indigenous struggle in this country, that it's always the artists and also sports people, but the artists who are at the forefront of it, and that people may not be realising they're listening to what is a highly politicised song, when they're dancing to it and they're listening to it and they're listening to language and they're listening to the lyrics, which are about, you know, handing back the country and the call for a treaty in this country. And in this case, a whole lot of gay guys dancing to it in a nightclub. It was fantastic.
Yes, you wonder if they sort of thought what it was about. But I suppose it works on all different levels, doesn't it?
Well, that's what I mean. It was interesting. For me, music is one of those things that affects you emotionally. It's almost, not you disengage intellectually, but it has a beeline straight to your heart, and you engage in a totally different level. You can almost take it in passively, if you like, and you don't have to think about it, but it kind of sits in your body. And in this case, you know, because it's such a groovy little dance mix, it's one of those moments where you can be moving to it before you even realise what you're listening to.
And Mandawuy Yunupingu must be one of the few people in the world who's both, you know, was a headmaster of a school and a rock star all at the same time.
Well, maybe all headmasters are rock stars in their own way. But, yeah, look, and you know this thing where I remember my grandmother, because I was always wanting to be a teacher or a doctor, and my grandmother said there's lots of ways of teaching and there's lots of ways of healing. And, you know, music is one of those things, especially in Aboriginal culture. You know, the whole idea of a whole bunch of people singing together and, you know, a communion, if you like, in that way is quite a beautiful thing.
And what sort of music, other music, turns you on, Wesley? What do you listen to?
Oh, at the moment I'm listening to Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, that kind of bluesy, rhythm and blues kind of stuff. It's interesting because I'm working on a show, The Sapphires, which was done ages ago, so I'm kind of into that kind of Motown kind of groove at the moment, which I'm quite excited by. And also I've been doing some work with the Black Armband, so I'm looking at a lot of Indigenous recordings of the last 10, 15 years and songs that kind of come up from there. And I mean, for me, one of those reasons of thinking about treaty is because it's just amazing that people have been able to find their story and their voice through music a lot.
And of course, in your job as a playwright and director, you'd use music quite calculatingly in order to get to an audience, wouldn't you?
Are you calling me manipulative?
No, not in the slightest.
Well, I think I am manipulative. And it's, you're right. I think, you know, everyone knows how a film works, that kind of suddenly this music comes in and you're transported somewhere else. And for me, music is a shorthand, if you like. It says, think like this, move like this, imagine this, without having to say all the words, without having to set the scene in a overly verbal way.
It's, that's right, yes.
Very emotional.
They often say that. That's just exactly when words fail, the music takes over.
Excellent, yeah.
Wesley, thanks for joining us this
no
morning.
Problem.
Great
thanks,
to
Guy.
Hear that, and great to hear a bit of treaty again. Let's take some more calls on Life Matters, 1300 22 55 76, and let's go to Paul in New South Wales. Your parents were quite influential, Paul.
Yes, they were. They had a band. I grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney, around Parramatta, and they had a band that was called the Lesters, which used to play in a few of the local clubs on a pretty regular basis. So the house was pretty much always filled with music when I was very young.
What sort of stuff do they play?
Evergreen type of tunes and dance numbers. You know, probably a couple of the ones that spring to mind, very tunes like In a Sentimental Mood and Try a Little Tenderness, and, you know, the list goes on.
So does it take you back when you hear those now?
Yeah, totally. Both my parents were, you know, very... my mother particularly was a very good musician, and she died when I was quite young. So this sort of happened through till I was about 12 and a half, I guess. And And when Mum died, not that that was the end of music in the house, but it was, you know, the end of the Lesters. So it's sort of, you know, a lot of that stuff's pretty emotional when I hear it.
Very much so. Yeah. Have you got any recordings of them to listen to?
No, I don't, sadly.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, we did have one old, you know, BASF tape of them, but somewhere in the process, you know, it got lost. I was overseas for a long time and, you know, so it went to try and find the thing in coming home, but it wasn't to be found.
Oh, thanks, Paul. Lovely to hear from you. And let's go to Owen next. What did you listen to, Owen?
G'day, Guy. How are you?
Very well.
That's great. It's it was a piece called Harlem Nocturne by the Ray Noble arranger.
No relation.
Earl Hagen.
Oh, yeah.
And I was at Alexandra High School and had a brass band there, which was wonderful. And I wanted to play drums, so I learnt to play the snare drum there. And but at home, listening, I discovered to Ralph Rickman's program called, I think it was just Jazz, the Jazz Scene, that's right, on a Tuesday night, at half past 10 at night, while I was a 14-year-old boy. And I would go to bed, but I'd take a radio to bed with me and I'd listen under the bedclothes to this beautiful theme of Harlem Nocturne, and it turned me on to jazz for the rest of my life so far.
Oh, I love how to do that, you know, secretly under the bedclothes, listening to jazz. It could be so much worse, couldn't it?
Oh, well, I mean, what a great way to do it. Warm and comfortable in cool Victoria at the time and listening to that sort of music. It was...
Your own little bedclothes jazz club. I love it.
That's
thanks.
Very cute.
Thanks, Owen. Tanya, if I could just come back to you for a moment. Your background is classical, of course, but does popular music move you too?
Yeah, it does. I've actually got more into popular music, and with potpourri, we've sort of crossed over a lot between opera and musical theatre and made a lot of the popular opera classics a bit more popular as well. And I love, you know, everything from sort of Leonard Cohen to, you know, to the Eagles, to, you know, Billy Joel and all the typical things that, you know, I think we all grew up with. So all that music takes me back as well. I suppose just classical music, there's something about it, you know, pieces by Puccini and Bizet and all those wonderful, and Mozart, of course, that, you know, have lasted for so many centuries, that the music somehow resonates with our psyche, I think, as human beings, and that's why the music has lasted so long. So for me, if I want to sort of calm myself down and get into a really peaceful spiritual state, I do listen to classical music, but I do love other kinds of music to hype me up and stuff.
That's right. And, you know, I'm sure there are some pieces that are written today that will probably stand the test of time, and we'll be listening to, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody in 100 years' time. And that's a good point to bring in our other guest, Tanya, which is Robbie Buck, who's just come straight down hot from breakfast up at Triple J.
That's right. Well, reasonably warm anyway at this stage.
And it's Triple J, you get really close on the microphone too, don't you?
Well, I don't know. Am I too close?
No, it was very nice. Amanda's saying you are in the booth there. So you've just come, yes, Triple J Hottest 100, and it's been quite interesting because they're not all things that are just, you know, last couple of years.
No, well, what we do each year, we do the Hottest 100 annually, and it's the last 12 months of music, but about every 10 years to celebrate the launch of the Hottest 100, because initially it was actually a Hottest 100 of all time, and for the first 2 years, that's how they ran it. You could choose any piece of music from, you know, the history of time. What they were finding was you were getting the same sorts of songs coming around again and again, so they changed it to only the last 12 months. For this year, the 20th anniversary of the countdown, we decided to reopen it once again as an all-time poll, and it was very interesting reading, you know, and listening to the outcomes of it. It certainly generated a lot of conversation and a lot of discussion, which is pretty much the main point of it too.
Yeah.
And some of those songs that were there back in 1989 are still going strong, and of course lots of them have gone by the wayside too.
They become classics, don't they?
Yeah.
We're going to have a listen to a little bit of one that comes in at number one. Now, this is fascinating because Anne-Marie, who's operating the desk out there and playing this track in the very moment, she actually met Nirvana when they came into Triple J in 1992, when they weren't big stars and apparently couldn't do more than go, into the microphone.
Well, I think actually the announcer who did that interview trashed the tape straight afterwards. She was so embarrassed by it.
This is before they became the big hit. But this is Nirvana and Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Hey!
fantastic stuff, isn't it?
I don't know how many times that's been played on Radio National.
But I think it's great.
I'm glad it is being played. Look, that was the number one song this year. It was actually the number one song when we did it 10 years ago as well, because we did another 10-year anniversary. So it's a song with a lot of staying power for the listeners of Triple J. And, of course, over the years, you get new listeners and, you know, listeners who get older move on to other radio stations and the like as well. So it was really interesting to note that it's lasted that length of time and is still so popular.
Let's just talk a bit about you and your interest in music. Mm. Where did it come from? What got you into it?
My brother was he's quite a bit older than me. He's probably nearly 10 years older than me, and he's always been a massive music fan. And, I mean, I can relate to that earlier caller that you had about listening to music in bed. I got given a transistor radio when I was probably about 7 or 8, and I used to smuggle it into my bedroom and slot it underneath the pillow and listen to Casey Kasem's American Top 40. Like, growing up in a town like Lismore, there wasn't a huge amount of
funny how it has to be so secretive.
Well, because you're supposed to be asleep. Oh, you don't want to sleep. You want to listen to Casey Kasem. And my parents were always into music as well. So I was surrounded by, my grandfather was a music teacher, was always surrounded by music and grown up with it. And there was, I'm compulsive in the way that I need music in my life. I will go home, immediately put music on, listen to music, you know, all day at work a lot of the time. And I use it as a way to kind of regulate my moods, but also to have that subtle expression as well. And it's something that, I guess, you know, feeds your sensibility of where you are and what you're doing. I'm somebody who really notices what the music is that's playing in cafes and supermarkets and things like that. You become kind of hypersensitive to it in some ways. But and now there is so much music being played, you can't really walk out your door without hearing things blaring.
When you work in music, does it sometimes make you want to not listen to it? Obviously, maybe not for you.
Look, it does get occasionally like that. I did a show a few years ago for Triple J, which was the Australian Music Show, and as part of that you had to listen to hundreds of demo tapes that were sent in to you. And part of that, listening to music which is unfamiliar to you and also not necessarily of the highest quality all the time, let's be frank, you do get fatigued from it sometimes, yeah. And there are times. I used to find, as opposed to not wanting to listen to music, what you can find yourself is wanting to go back to things that are very personal to you, things that you listened to when you were younger. Because I think the way you absorb music when you're younger is very different to the way you absorb it when you're older. I think you're more open as a child when you're hearing music, and so the way it affects you is actually it's somehow more so than it is when you're older. The way that you absorb it and the emotional kind of reaction that you have from it seems to be a little bit stronger when you're younger. So some of those songs are always very close to your heart as you get older. They seem to rekindle those sorts of feelings.
Robbie, thanks so much for coming down from Triple J.
That's okay.
The hallowed halls of Radio National. It's lovely to have Robbie Buck from Triple J. And we're going to put the hottest 100 of all time on the Life Matters website as well.
I'll be interested to see how you the response with that. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's great. There are a whole lot of golden oldies. And I think Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody at number 6, you know, out of all the choices and from a much younger age group.
Yeah.
Because we're talking what, sort of, you know,
18 to 25 is the bulk of our voters. Yeah.
So they've got good taste.
There was Beatles in there. There was Kashmir by Led Zeppelin. Yeah, there's a bunch.
They're all classics.
There's a lot.
Robbie, thanks. Let's get back to a few more calls on our Friday talk back here on Life Matters on Radio National. Graham in New South Wales, Chopin for you.
Yes.
What was it about that composer?
Well, I was brought up in Broken Hill and went to Broken Hill High School, and at the age of about 14, I was just as mad as all the rest of the kids into football and everything else, and we had nothing to do with music. My dad was a miner. We only had just a radio in the house, and heard some pop songs, and of course the theme tune to First Light, Fraser. But one Friday afternoon, we were given the opportunity by the music teacher to walk all the way downtown for a music concert, classical music, and we weren't into classical music at all. but we're getting out of maths, and so, I mean, that was the motivation. And down we went, and we're all messing around just like typical kids, and we were sitting in this theatre, and the lights dimmed, and we were going to take the mic and throw things. And suddenly, Chopin's Overture to Les Sylphides came. They played this. And it was as if the world stopped. I was just it just hit me between the eyes, and I just gasped.
Oh, really?
And that was the beginning of my love of classical music. So I joined the fife and drum band at the school. and I look back on it now, and at Broken Hill High School, we were taught all these lovely folk songs and classicals, you know, singing like the Trout and that. And I naturally assumed that everybody learned these things, but apparently they don't. And then when I went to India some years later, and I was looking after kids up in the mountains in the Himalayas, and we had a lot of abandoned kids and Tibetan refugees and that, and of course they had no music except Radio Ceylon on Saturday night. So I managed to get a lot of bamboo flutes for 20 cents each, and we started a fife and drum band there. And it started music in the lives of all these kids. And
it's great, that, isn't it? It's like you're sort of perpetuating what happened to you as well.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, we had to actually ban practicing the flute because we actually had kids up trees playing the flute and trying to learn it, and there's this awful noise. You've got no idea what it was like.
Not like Chopin. Graham, thanks so much for calling this morning on Life Matters. Let's also go to David, who's also in New South Wales. David, what was your experience of
music?
Oh,
look, you know, I'm 60. I'm so privileged to be 60 because I was there in the 60s at university in England when revolution struck, and Hendrix, the Stones, and the Who were the wallpaper to our revolution, if you like. You know, Danny LaRed was in Paris. Street Fighting Man was playing with a Rolling
Oh, what a shame. I think we just lost David there, but he was talking about a revolutionary time. I was looking forward to hearing more of that. Thanks, David, for calling. That's Jim, also in New South Wales. What was your favourite piece?
Pie, American Pie.
Ah, yes.
And it relates to my daughter, Tracy Brooke. She represented at Calgary in figure skating.
Ah, and did she use that music, or what was the connection?
No, that was the first program she skated to in Newcastle here, the first competition she went to when she was eight year old.
Oh,
and it really, really touches a lot of sensitive areas when I hear it on the, and a mother too.
It's a great song, and of course, it's a long song too. She would have skated to all nine, I think it's 9 minutes of American Pie, a lot of pie. This is Life Matters on Radio National, and we're talking about music and its effect on you. And it's great to welcome to the studio Stephen Crittenden, who's got a big program about music on Background Briefing.
Indeed.
Hi, Stephen. This is all sort of, it's all come about through synchronicity, but I heard a little of your report on Breakfast this morning that Fran played. Just tell us a bit about the subject of the story.
Well, What the story's about is the very variable quality of school music in Australia. Most people would be aware that our wealthy private schools, most of them have very fine, often very well-endowed music departments and a lot going on. What's much less well-known is that at the other end of the spectrum, there's almost no music going on. And we were astounded to find that perhaps as many as one in three state primary schools, certainly in New South Wales and possibly for the rest of Australia, have no music of any kind. There's a great shortage of specialist music teachers in that all-important primary school level. Everyone says if you don't get the music then, it's too late by secondary school, and the role of a secondary school music teacher becomes a very soul-destroying one. Queensland is way out in front. It's got specialist music teachers in most primary schools. It hasn't done away with that. But the view is that Australia needs around about 6,000 specialist music teachers. 6,000 primary schools around the country don't have a specialist music teacher.
It's a terrible figure, and I know that my other guest, Tani de Jong in Melbourne, is nodding furiously there, even though I can't see her at the moment. Tani, does that resound with you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, and Stephen would know about the Song Room, and
the Song Room, I think, is an amazing organisation that we should know more about, because you're really going in at the very bottom end, aren't you, doing things that
that's right. The Song Room works with the most disadvantaged schools that have the least access. And, you know, there are some 700,000 Australian students estimated who don't have music, and We should have music as part of everyone's life and curriculum. It's essential.
Because what we're hearing today from many of our listeners also is how important it was that first teacher or someone, usually in a school, quite early on, like Mr. Shearman from Christine of New South Wales, who played classical music.
And often it's a story about a teacher playing records.
That's right.
Often it's that. The other thing I should say, and this is sort of the other side of the coin away from specialist teachers, and that is if you go back in time, generalist classroom teachers in primary school had a good grounding in music, you know, 100 years ago. In the last 20 years in particular, that has their training for generalist primary teachers has contracted. It's almost minuscule. Out of 30 Australian universities, 17 of them in their Bachelor of Education degree offer about less than 2% of their time in generalist sort of classroom to music.
And yet, as I think you say in the report, all the research, and Tanya was talking about this before, says that, you know, exposure to music and learning about it has such an enormous effect on education right down the track. So yeah. It seems astonishing that we've just let it slip off the radar.
Yes, and the politicians are being told this. Brain developments, cognitive developments, kids with who get music tend to do very well in subjects like maths and science and English, increased IQ scores, but also helps kids with learning difficulties. There's research that shows that if a kid's having trouble learning to read, you can take him out or him or her out of reading class, give them music, and their reading will improve.
One thing I wanted to ask you is that when we talk about exposure to music, in what way? I mean, obviously, children now probably listen to more music than, you know, we're slightly older, because with iPods and, you know, they've got 26 gigabytes of music on their iPod.
It hasn't stopped being a musical culture.
That's right. So is it the participation in music? Is it actually playing
music?
Absolutely.
That's what it is. It's not a performance culture, except you watch Australian Idol and you think, well, it is still a performance culture,
yes,
in a way. People do value that.
Tanya, does the song room encourage people to perform and to get instruments and do that sort of thing, or just listen to it? What is the...
Oh, no, it's all about participation, certainly, in the song room. And also my new organisation that you mentioned, Creativity Australia, is all about unlocking the innate creativity that we all have. And it is very much about participation in choirs and other organisations to bring people together and
that's
to
for
enhance
adults.
People's
adults,
well-being.
Isn't it? Yes.
Absolutely, yeah.
You've missed out on the secondary school experience.
And the primary one.
Oh, dear.
You know, there was a great study done that showed 3 to 5 year old kids exhibit 98% creative behaviour, and by the time we get to 25, we're exhibiting 2% creative behaviour, but it's still there and it's waiting to be unlocked. And if we can unlock that creativity within all of us, that will lead to a greater social and economic good in Australia.
It has benefits, doesn't it? Stephen, before I let you go, what piece of music, I mean, you have a very broad range and interest in music. What really gets to you?
I went to the Nuns, which is an old story. I went to the Nuns to learn piano. That's a very old Australian story, and of course there aren't any nuns, or there aren't as many nuns anymore. So that very important social story about Australia has dried up to some extent. I have this vivid memory of sitting down, and it would have been about 1971. I would have been about 8 years old. Captain Cook's arrival in Botany Bay had been hugely celebrated in Australia the year before, and I remember sitting down with this piece of music by someone called J.S. Bach, 1685 to 1750, and at about 6 years old thinking, that's really interesting. This piece of music would have been written just before Captain Cook came to Australia. I wonder had he heard it. And I always remember this nun saying to me when I was playing this famous piece, the Minuet in G by Bach, saying, try it with the left hand a little bit louder, dear. You'll hear there's a melody in the left hand too. And it was like this window opening, and I've been having a love affair with J.S. Bach ever since.
And then you get to talk about it on Radio National. Stephen Crittenden, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Of course, your report's on Background Briefing on Sunday at 9 in the morning here on ABC Radio National. Look forward to listening to
thanks
that.
Thanks very much.
Let's take another call just before we wrap up. Ian in New South Wales, what was your first experience?
Hi, Guy. We all, the four siblings, my father taught us by rote at home from the age of about four, all of us, Spanish guitar method, with the raw over the knuckles type situation when we learnt, and it progressed to the municipal band, which all three boys went into. I played, in fact, tuba, But what the producer and you were discussing just recently, what helped me with learning music early was math later on in school. You know, so there is a correlation between learning music early and you know, I still play music now. I mean, I'm 50, and I mean, classical right through to anything on the guitar and on a G string, you know, because I can play that and read music, and it's very important, you know. I found that significantly beneficial, especially with people who sort of problematically in schools nowadays don't have music, you
know? That's right, and as Stephen was talking about before, you know, the whole learning difficulties, and it can get right through to children. Thanks, Ian, for that call. And Tanya, I'll just come back to you before we wrap up today. Is there one transformational experience you've seen, for instance, in an adult? You were talking about Creativity Australia. Just, is there one experience you've got there?
Yeah, no, definitely. Look, we've set up a choir called Melbourne Sings that brings together employees from various city businesses, so executives and chairmen and people like that, with migrants from the housing estates. And it's an amazing model for bridging social capital, where we provide employment pathways for some of those migrants who don't have jobs. And this lady from the Cameroon who'd come out, quite an intelligent lady, but, you know, a bit unconfident with English, and she was going for a job, and she was very nervous, and she came to choir practice and she was a bit teary. And so the choir leader and a few others of us went up to her and, you know, gave her confidence over a couple of weeks. And she loves to sing, and it's really important to her. And she started to just feel much better. And she went for her interview, and she got her job on the spot. And now she gets up in front of the choir and tells her story proudly. And she's like one of our spokespersons who advocates the message of, you know, how much music has brought to her and how it makes her feel a part of Australia.
Well, that's a great story to end on. Tanya de Jong, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Good luck with the Song Room and the Creativity Australia and all your other endeavours.
Thank you.
So that's our Friday Talk Back this morning. Thanks to Tanya de Jong from Potpourri and Creativity Australia, and to Robbie Buck, and my other guests, David Hobson, Wesley Enoch and Stephen Crittenden. And, of course, thanks to the wonderful team behind the scenes here at Life Matters, who've made being here such a joy. Amanda, Anne-Marie, Jane, Ali, Anne and Tracy, they're all out there gazing at the moment. I'm Guy Noble. Richard Ady is back with Life Matters on Monday, when you're going to hear more about Karl Marx's Love Child. Of course, the book show is next with Ramona Cavall, but we're going to go out with a little bit of the number 6 on the Triple J Hottest 100, Bohemian Rhapsody.
Issue really is, does the world really, really make sense, or is it in the end only a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury? I think the universe is not a chaos, a meaningless chaos in the end. It is a cosmos. It really does make sense, but I can only believe that if I believe there is a faithful God behind its history.
As theologians grapple with the big issues of our times, such as climate change, the schism between science and religion is being transformed.
For me, there is something providential about climate stability. So by messing with it, we're not just messing with the planetary thermostat. We're messing with the geological, a geographical, a geophysical context which makes our faith and its continuity across time possible.
That's Bridging the Divide on Encounter, and you can download this program from the Radio National website.